If there are any questions, Carl has the microphone, and if you want to just field the questions here,
Sure.
Great.
Yes.
Okay, you get the point.
This gentleman.
Dr. Toyota, I understand why the post office is failing and public education is failing and Amtrak. What I haven't seen or haven't heard, maybe I don't know, the whole the private information issue that you addressed this evening, is there any evidence, is there anything that has happened yet, anything we can point to say, this is why we can't disseminate personal information, this is why it's a problem. Has anything happened yet where the government has intruded on private information and damage has been done?
That's a very good question. And I would personally solicit from all of you, if you have personal experiences that you would be willing to share with me, I would like to have those instances. I do not have, I'm trying to think, a particular instance does not come to mind as far as a particular individual who was damaged by this. What you have is increasingly the government is setting up rules that are said to be privacy rules, so that we are supposed to feel wonderful that our medical records, our financial records, all of these things are going to be protected. But what has actually happened is, in the fine print, there are exceptions which allow all of this information to be shared, especially among government agencies. So, and what we will encounter, what we are already encountering, for example, with the medical databases that are being constructed, is that people will say, well, there's not just one national database, and that's true. But what they've done is to standardize the format of electronic databases of personal medical information on each one of us, about what we say privately to our doctor, all kinds of personal things. And what it means is that somebody with a couple of computer keystrokes can obtain information not only about all of our financial records, checks, deposits, those things, but also such things as our educational records, our medical records, and the like. So to me, I think history, even though I can't cite John Jones, who was damaged as a result of this, history tells us in terms of what has happened in other countries where the government has acquired this amount of control, that people have been damaged. Also, one other thing I would point out is that Jeffrey Rosen, who is a lawyer who studies privacy issues, recently, a few months ago, wrote an article in the Sunday New York Times, and he told about how in Britain, surveillance cameras were set up in the wake of terrorist attacks in 1992-93. They haven't caught any terrorists, but they have a horrendous number of surveillance cameras all around London and other places in England. And what has happened, what he documented, he actually went into these places, and they're using the cameras to look at people's social behavior. I'll leave it, it's just saying, social behavior. And so what people are doing is self-censoring. So they act differently in public because they know they're always on camera. And I think that the same thing applies to our other types of records of our activities.
If you don't mind, I've got a couple examples of where people have been harmed. There are lots of them.
Excellent.
One of the most dramatic ones that I know of was the case of Donald Scott in Malibu, California, who was a wealthy rancher. And he was seen around town, passed around $100 bills. So anyway, the police started to investigate him, found he owned a valuable piece of property that backed up to national parkland, and decided they wanted to seize the property. The Park Service attempted to buy it, he refused to sell it, he loved the place he lived on. So anyway, what happened was that they manufactured evidence that he was growing marijuana, which was turned out to be totally false. Mm-hmm. And the reason he was targeted was because he owned his property. And you see this again and again, where people are targeted for asset forfeiture. In his case,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Something like 32 police broke into his home early one morning and shot him dead. So that's an example. And there's another example, New Jersey, another forfeiture example, is a woman named Kathy Schramm against she owned her home. She was lucky enough to own her home. And she was accused of stealing two packages from a neighbor's porch. Mm-hmm. You know, two UPS packages maybe worth $50. Anyway, instead of just simply charging her with petty theft, which would be the normal thing to do, the police investigated, found out from records that they had that she owned her home, and they seized her house. They came by one evening, told her you have 15 minutes to get out with your children, and took the house.
Yes, I understand that historically there is a precedent. It's something like first comes registration, then comes regulation, and this was supposed to be true in Nazi Germany where people registered their guns. Mm-hmm. So I think the big problem is, although you can't and I don't know, who knows yet what they have planned for us, it's the potential that I would believe that we're all concerned about. And if we don't start now, when do you do it? After it's already a fait accompli? Mm-hmm. So that's why I think what you say is very relevant, because with that information there is so much power. And it may not be today or tomorrow, but it could be next year or 3 years or 4 years from now. And I think that's why this is a worthwhile discussion.
Mm-hmm. I would say that a watched people is not a free people. When we are constantly watched, we change our behavior. And in terms of an historical example, I should have mentioned when the first gentleman spoke, the example in our country, the most dramatic one, is the rounding up of Japanese Americans during World War II. So that would be an example of federal information being used to the detriment of innocent law-abiding American citizens.
Yes, and this is, I think we can all identify with this. When you go into, when you buy an old home or any home, and if they don't have a low-flow toilet, you know, you have to change, and you must. And if not, the city health department or the city, I mean, again, registration comes regulation. So on a very personal level, I think there are lots of instances where all this information can be used against you.
Thank you. Oh, in the very back, you, that person.
This one?
Yes.
Two quickies, Charlotte. One was, is the information that you spoke of today, or is it mostly in the book?
Yes.
Okay. Second question is, the students with whom you instruct, where are they on this? Are they willing to give up their Social Security? Are they willing to let government be less intrusive?
It's very interesting because I have started every single semester, you know, I have to talk about Social Security a little bit, tell them some of the facts of life here. But what I do before starting to talk about that is that I ask them to write on a little slip of paper, just without their name or anything, what the payroll tax is, what the burden of the payroll tax to them. And almost always, except for a very few students, 90% of them, say that it's 6.2% or something in the neighborhood of that. So my question would be, how are they to evaluate the benefits and burdens of a Social Security system when they're going around thinking that the tax is half of what it is? So they're always, they become, I think, a little bit more cynical and disheartened about these things because they realize that what's coming down for them 40 years down the road, and so they know it's going to cost them a lot of money. But even so, they do not perceive the true magnitude of the problem. So I'm doing my little part to
a lot of what you said would seem to conform to the ideas of some groups and people who believe that it's come about in a very planned fashion, and that it may have started sometime around the early 1900s, and that they believe the next step is to, you know, formulate some form of world government, which is even more intrusive and more powerful. I wonder what your ideas are on that.
Well, I don't subscribe to any conspiracy theories. My way of looking at things is that there are a lot of politicians out there and interest groups, special interests, people of, you know, various people. And the politicians are using tactics that work well in politics. They're trying to advance their own interests in one way or another. And it just so happens that it leads in one direction, towards greater power for the central government. And I hope what you said about the trend towards world government is does not come to pass. We have to get smarter if it's not going to come to pass. I've been unfair to this half of the room, the gentleman in the middle there, and then the woman in front of.
Yes, you've brought up some interesting interpretations of the interstate clause and the justice it used. I got a question. Have you also contrasted how they've used the promote the general welfare clause? There is great debate in the Federalist mm-hmm. and Anti-Federalist papers on what it really meant.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, enumerated powers are tied mm-hmm. to it. And it seems like they have expanded it considerably in the last 50 years or so.
Absolutely. That's another very good example of, I think the founders never anticipated that this type of tactic could be used, where the plain meaning of the words at the time that the Constitution was adopted were simply changed by judicial action. And consequently, their concept of limited government has been so dramatically altered.
I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate.
All right.
But my question is, it seemed that our country was unprepared for the attack of September 11th. With as much information as they have about us as they do, they seem that they didn't protect us, which is their mm-hmm. number one mm-hmm. responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
What would you have the government do going forward instead of putting greater surveillance and greater intelligence? Because it seems like their intelligence was inferior. Obviously, it didn't protect us.
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting question. From what I've read, one argument is that they had quite a bit of information, and that the difficulty was that there was already so much information clogging the pipeline, so to speak, in terms of intelligence, that there were messages that should have been decoded, but they were 3 days behind, and so they didn't get to the messages until too late. So I think one argument would be that perhaps we should look at what are the sources of the intelligence failure that allowed September 11th to happen. But it seems that people don't want to look at why that intelligence failure happened, because that might say there are some deficiencies in some of our intelligence gathering agencies. Instead, the immediate federal response, within days of the attack, instead of saying what led to these intelligence failures, having a public conversation about that, and within government and between government and the citizens and so on. Instead of that, almost immediately, they trotted out legislation which contained provisions that they'd been trying to get for years and years and years. So the automatic solution seems to be to put into place new powers instead of examining whether those, in fact, are called for by the circumstances. The other theme that I have detected in light of the main theme of my book is that once again they have used political language to hide what's actually in the bills. I mean, it was very dismaying to me when I found out that they had come up with this law that, where legislators sat around in a room and figured out words, uniting and strengthening America, by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism. Well, so you get the acronym for that, and it's USA Patriot Act. And so that means nobody can vote against it. And most ordinary people don't have time to read the fine print. They're going to assume that this is a patriotic thing. We've got to do it. And it's against the terrorists, which sounds like a fine and laudable purpose. Once you have a name like that for a statute, you can just about put anything into it, and it's very hard for legislators to vote against it. So what we found out after the fact is that there are various provisions that many experts think are severe threats to our constitutional rights, Fourth Amendment, and so on. So I think we should at least have a conversation about it and not just go automatically to government's got to have more information.
I have this, like, a two-part question, I think. What is the connection? I haven't read the book yet. We just got it tonight. But with multinational corporations that I view as being engines that are providing massive amounts of money, but a lot of their loyalty and responsibility for business goes out of the country, and yet they're American-based companies. I view this as a possible fuel, an engine for legislators and things to get further out of control, as you're describing. And can you discuss a few thoughts about this phenomena, where if we had established plants in China and in Europe, and they're legitimate businesses, they're sort of pulling us along and pulling the politicians along and everyone. And so
you said about the multinational corporations providing all money, did I understand you correctly, money to government officials and things like that?
Yes, I think it happens here and elsewhere, that they're a generator of power, of money power,
mm-hmm.
and of product.
Mm-hmm.
And so this has to have some kind of impact in maybe lessening our ability to have our legislators represent us.
Mm-hmm.
And a strictly voting standpoint, how do you deal with that?
I think I think that's a very good question, and many people are concerned about multinational corporations. They're, of course, concerned about things like campaign finance and, you know, money flowing in that way. I'm always hesitant to talk about the details of reform proposals without first just pausing to think about the fact that in my view, a huge part of the problem is that the government has so much power to begin with. If the government didn't have so much discretionary power, then there wouldn't be the incentive, both for good companies and bad companies, to funnel money into the system. It's either protection money or they're trying to get something, but the incentive wouldn't be there if the government did not have such broad discretionary authority to begin with.
It may be an interesting topic for you to further research at some point, do another
one. Perhaps
so. My last question, is that young man your son?
No.
Son.
But he's he looks like a very nice young man.
You know, when I hear this conversation, there's in the questions to you in general, there's a projection about what's somebody else going to do about these issues. And so I guess when I listen to this stuff, I say, what am I going to do about this? And to me, there's only, you know, the question that you asked about accusing the government of not protecting us, which is true, but the consequence of it is, instead of saying there's a certain risk of living, of driving an automobile, living in this country, don't play with anything. You know, we also each individually respond for more protection, which in my opinion gives the government more power. But I think on an individual basis, I think we have to elect people locally, personally work to elect people locally who subscribe to these principles. And when we don't participate, we passively give them permission to take these kinds of powers, and we give them up.
I think that I always think about my neighbors and why they're not doing anything about these things, and I think many people are sort of lulled into complacency. So they've got their jobs, their incomes, and the like, and that's an excuse. And so they don't do anything. Yes, absolutely. And from my point of view, I think people need to understand that many of their public officials, you know, have a sort of cynical disregard for them. And I think that only when more people become aware of these things, well, they perceive that there's a problem. I mean, people in this room obviously perceive that there's some kind of problem. And so I think that's a motivator to say, I've got to do something myself. Nobody else is going to do it for me. Another response to what you said is it's very striking that people in this country are willing to send young men and women abroad to fight and die for freedom as they conceive of it. And yet, when something strikes close to home, where we might have to bear a little bit of extra personal risk if we refrain from expanding the powers of the central government, people are not wanting to do that. So I think your points are very well taken.
Way in the back.
Way in the back.
Pretty much, we said the Pasadena here, he says, law is justice.
One of my interests is, I mean, it's a terrible thing to be taxed heavily on your payroll taxes and everything. It's even more of an infringement of the state when the cops show up at your door and lead you away in handcuffs. That's the ultimate infringement of the state. One of the earlier speakers mentioned the business of asset forfeiture, which is going on in spades in the drug war. Mm-hmm. Just yesterday, we had the feds show up in Oakland and San Francisco and shut down our medical marijuana clubs. Let us have your comments on the whole drug war and how it fits into your way of thinking. Thank you.
I don't discuss the drug war in the book, so let me just give you a couple of thoughts about that. The drug war is, I think, poses the same dangers that the war against terrorism poses, in the sense that if you have something that sounds very appealing to many people in the population, then that's going to be used as an excuse to do a lot of things that that otherwise people would not go along with. So I think that's one of the biggest dangers. And there's some discussion in the book about the asset forfeiture laws and how those have been misapplied, but not a broad discussion of the war on drugs.
I think the Patriot Bill
was
passed even before it was written.
Oh, yes, that's true. That's true.
Even before it was written. No one even read it.
Yes, I'm so glad, Connie, right?
Yeah.
I'm so glad Connie brought that up, because that was just shocking. I mean, shouldn't these people be fired? They passed a bill into law, the USA Patriot Act, containing many provisions that, as I said, scholars are very worried about as threats to civil liberties and the Fourth Amendment and such. They didn't read the thing. They just said, oh, well, it's USA Patriot Act. Fine. I'm in favor of it. Seems like that should be a fireable offense. Yeah. Don't vote for them. Vote for different ones.
Shame them.
David said shame them. I think that's a really good thing, to publicize these sorts of actions and talk to your neighbors about it and your colleagues.
I'd like to point out a factual matter and then pose a question slightly on a different subject. One thing that this obsessive gathering of information did for the Germans was that they had it all neatly filed away and easily retrievable by the latest state-of-the-art predecessor to the computer, the card sorter made by IBM Corporation, so that when they wanted to find a particular group of people, it was very easy to pull up all their names, addresses, and every other characteristic they might need to find them and go after them.
Mm-hmm.
You suggest that you don't believe in any conspiracy theory, and yet throughout your presentation this evening, you've said that these people went at it essentially with malice aforethought. That is, they understood the implications of what they were doing. Of course, these people all acted totally independently of each other and never discussed it with anyone else. They would have to be at least conspiring with their immediate fellows in the thing. And I suggest also that in many cases this such legislation is now proposed by think tanks, groups of people who have resident experts who have done deep study on psychological motivations and political levers and word twisting and things of that sort, and they're well aware of the cumulative effect of some new proposed legislation with what already exists. So I suggest that there's at least, if not some overarching single conspiracy that subsumes them all together in one, that there are at least many other small conspiracies going at any one time to bring this about.
I would agree that like-minded people in Congress, as in other places, try to do things that will get them more of what they want with less resistance from other people. But it seems to me that in any group of human beings, you have some people who are, you know, trying to do devious things to get more power, exert power over others. And there are other people who are trying to do a good job. I have a really nice historical quote in the book from Isabel Patterson, saying that most of the harm in the world is not done by evil people, but for people persisting in trying to do what they think, bring about what they think is going to be for the good. But be that as it may, I actually have many instances documented in the book where some group of so-called experts in Congress have a particular interest in one bill, will actually try and orchestrate the circumstances so that it is very difficult for their colleagues to know what's in the bill or to vote against it. So I have a fancier term in the book for it, because it's within government. Sometimes within government you have this sort of effort by various individuals to try to raise the cost to other people in government of figuring out what's going on and resisting it if they might like to resist it. So I see a colleague of mine once talked about it's less like a conspiracy than writhing snakes trying to accomplish something. So they have their individual purposes. Sometimes they come together, sometimes they do not. But the overall pattern is towards the success of these. I mean, what seems to work in politics is these, what I call transaction cost manipulating strategies that raise the cost to other people of perceiving what's going on and taking action to resist it.
It seems to me like those folks who write laws have found ways of using the give and take between security and liberty. You know, and the example that comes to my mind right now is the one where we've got these cameras on traffic lights to take pictures of cars that go through yellow and red lights, and then you get a bill in the mail.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe you could react to that.
To me, one of the most worrisome things about that is this idea of people getting used to the change. So if people just adjust to that and say, well, okay, these are the rules now, we have these little cameras around, what's the next step? What's the next generation going to think about those things? Well, there will have been cameras around on the traffic lights and wherever else for all of their lives. And so suddenly it gets ratcheted up to a new stage where next level of surveillance will encounter even less resistance.
And And, you know, we've relied on the courts to protect us from things like that, and now the court says that that's perfectly okay.
Yeah. It's a troublesome thing.
The logic would tell you that there's something wrong with that.
Mm-hmm. I agree. There was a gentleman right behind you.
I want to go back to the prior question about the tangled worms.
The writhing snakes.
Writhing snakes, yes. One word comes to mind as you were talking about that, and that's Enron. Because of what's happened recently with Enron, we're seeing legislative initiatives with regard to retirement plans, with regard to campaign finance,
mm-hmm.
And with regard mm-hmm. to counting, so forth and so on. And obviously that has happened because there's this feeling of there's something wrong and terrible that's happened and we've got to take action. Now the politicians are in a feeding frenzy about it, and I understand why. But what's interesting to me is that the media seems to have a presumption that we must do something. Their reporting is generally along those lines. Now there are some exceptions, like the Wall Street Journal today was talking about how campaign finance reform is not campaign finance reform. But that doesn't happen very often. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about what the media has to do with a lot of this?
Read the book Bias.
Yeah. Yes. That's number one on the charts now, I think. Yeah, I guess it's hard to get a hold of a copy right now, but I'm sure that they will reprint a lot more. I think that that is a very important thing. In fact, in the sort of one part of my book in chapter two, I talk about the role of the media in concealing some of these types of strategies that I've been talking about this evening. So in my own view, I think that's a big part of it. And it's very interesting in the case of Enron. Once again, something happens, people think it's terrible. The first move is, as you said, to suggest all these other government powers that we need to establish. And I'm also led back to the comment that you were reacting to, because it's very nice. You know, you have a quick solution, so everybody can, my neighbors can say, oh, well, that's taken care of. They're going to pass some new laws. I don't have to do anything, you know. So I think people need, I hope that eventually all of our neighbors will become alert to the fact that there is a problem and that they are going to have to do something, or their children are going to come to maturity in a much different society than the one that we've been privileged to experience.
This whole situation, of course, is very worrisome, but I'm mindful that there are possible solutions which have been alluded to from time to time. Within the last 6 months, Antonin Scalia made an offhand comment at the end of a speech that the American people at any time can propose constitutional amendments. But most people aren't aware of this, and my husband and I frequently have disputes about this, that this whole thing has come about, I believe, because the American people wound up having laws made or passed to their detriment by the legislative bodies, which instead of, at one time, historically, they were part-time legislatures, would only be there for like 3 months and then go home, and the emphasis at that time was legislation, quality legislation, not quantity. Now we have the flip side of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have privately told people from time to time over the past several years that I think, at least to my mind, one way that could put a break on that kind of thing is a constitutional amendment for Congress, that no legislation could be passed unless every single member of Congress who voted yea or nay, an abstention wouldn't qualify, but that they had to sign a declaration with that legislation that they had read it first.
Excellent. I think that's an excellent idea. It's very interesting, though, about Scalia's comments. I believe, if I'm thinking of the correct remark, he was talking about the Trusted Traveler program. And he said,
It was a trusted traveler.
Yeah. The comment that I read was he was speaking to, was it a college group, I think? And he made the remark that, well, if you don't like this trusted traveler card, which many people fear is going to grow into what amounts to a national ID card, then why don't you just, you know, go ahead and propose a constitutional amendment to forbid it? Well, a friend and colleague of mine, Sheldon Richman, sent me a note about this, and he pointed out how this exactly dovetails with my theory, because the costs of political action were exactly flipped by this means. They're saying now that the default is the government can do whatever it wants to do. If we want to stop it, we have to bear the cost of putting into place a constitutional amendment to forbid it. So, so there are some big problems. I agree with you. Behind her.
In regard to one of the first statements.
Can you please hold the microphone horizontally?
Okay. Collected information has often been used by people who leak it to the press to do somebody in, and the press tends to go along with it, and that's one of the real downsides of having all kinds of information out there. One of the things I wanted to point out about the 9/11 event and our protection, I believe that if some of the controllers had told the media the minute that the airlines had been hijacked, a lot of people would have been able to figure out that they were headed towards the World Trade Center in Washington, D.C., and thousands of people might have been saved.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. In the back?
What are your thoughts on the Libertarian Party as an antidote to some of the problems you raised?
I'm in favor of any group or organization that's working towards liberty. I think that we need to change people's ideas, and I think that's what the Independent Institute is about. I think that's what the Libertarian Party is about, and so I think that's a fine thing to the extent that they are informing people about some very fundamental issues pertaining to liberty. I would also note that the election rules, as you know, are so structured against third parties that it makes it very, very difficult for them to be successful at the ballot box.
Okay.
Thank you.
A couple items I might just throw in from my own perspective, for those of you who can who can bear it. On this issue of conspiracy theory, the one way to look at this is that people have ambitions and they plan and they try to seek goals for whatever purposes. But I think a lot of economists would suggest that there are competing interests who do this within the government system. And to do that, to essentially acquire the police power to use for their own purposes. The problem is not just that there's this process where people try to use government power for their own purpose, because the power is there, as Charlotte is saying, but also the process itself actually creates a problem, because there is no real check on it. And that's what the founders were basically saying, that you have to check the power of the state, because voting is very inefficient, and voters don't know what's going on, and so on and so forth. One thing that we have had great pride in is in working with Charlotte, because Charlotte exemplifies the scholar who takes enormous care and is very precise in her work, in documenting each step of the way. The academic world, in many respects, is politicized, like many other parts of our lives, but Charlotte Twight is one person who is not. And that's another reason why this book is a very important one. Two other small little things I might just throw out also. In the aftermath of the 9/11 tragedy and horror, in looking at the failure of U.S. intelligence, another dimension of this, I think, is to realize that this is really a reflection of the failure, in my opinion, of centrally planning information gathering, which is not what the founders had in mind either. One area that we were involved in doing work on, one of our fellows has done studies on our website, for example, on one provision in the Constitution, which is right after the war-making power in the very first article, is a provision where Congress can issue so-called letters of marque and reprisal. And for those of you who are not, let me ask you, anybody who is not familiar with letters of marque and reprisal, raise your hand. Letters of marque and reprisal were used by Congress in the first 50 years or so of the Republic as the major means of raising a military force by hiring privateers. And this was done through the War of 1812 and many other conflicts, going after pirates, essentially, and terrorists of those of that age. And there are quotes from Jefferson and Madison and others who are quite pleased with this process of having competing entities which were bonded, and yet they would be responsible if they themselves committed murders and so forth. And it was so efficient that there was a treaty drawn up in the mid-19th century to outlaw it among all the governments, because the government navies that existed, which were the major military forces then, didn't like being shown up by these different entities. If you're interested, it's on our website under Working Papers. And right after the 9/12 incident, there was a bill submitted by Congressman Ron Paul to authorize the use of letters of marque and reprisal. There was also news accounts of a $1 billion bounty fund that was being put together by a number of high-tech executives. And you can imagine the possibility of raising a bounty fund from the families of those who were killed, the insurance companies, and most Americans. It would be an enormous fund. And those of you who follow such things will know that in the criminal justice field, bounty hunters are far more efficient than any police agency in getting their man, because that's how they get paid. And it was our suggestion that that would be the way to proceed without the need for bombing villages and so on and so forth. Anyway, without going off into other further tangents, those of you who have not obtained a copy again of Charlotte's book, we hope that you will do so, and I'm sure she'll be delighted to autograph copies for those of you who have not had your copy autographed. We're delighted that you joined with us. I want to thank Charlotte again for her work and for you. And for you all for joining with us and making this such a successful event. We look forward to seeing you next time. Good night.